Thanks a lot for the invitation. I'm very happy to be giving a seminar at Perimeter Institute, even if I'm a bit far, you know, due to the situation. But I was there some years ago and I found the place amazing. So I'm really thankful for having been invited again. And today I'm going to talk about something that is actually sort of a continuation from the work I already presented there some years ago. And this work is based on two papers that we put on archive last December, which have these references here. And it has to do with the entropy decay for Davis semigroups of a one-dimensional quantum lattice. So what I'm going to do today is, well, first of all, I'm going to introduce and motivate the problem that I'm going to discuss during the talk. Then I will introduce the tools, the necessary tools that we need to explore and to discuss in order to obtain the main result that I will present towards the end. Once I introduce these tools, since they are a bit abstract, I will present some simple examples where these tools can be used so that you see how they work. And finally, I will present the main result that is contained in the papers that I just mentioned before. Okay, so let's start from the beginning. So today we are going to talk about some topic that is on the interplay between quantum information theory and quantum many-body systems. And in particular, we are going to talk about open many-body systems and about the dissipative evolutions of certain quantum many-body systems. More specifically, we will talk about the velocity of convergence of some thermal dissipative evolutions to their thermal equilibriums. And for that, what we will do is to introduce some mathematical concepts, some mathematical tools that are these Lhotse-Walleff constants. And we will discuss when we have sufficient static conditions on a certain thermal state, a Gibbs state, that imply the existence of such a positive constant, such a positive Lhotse-Walleff constant. So at the beginning, I'm going to go a bit slow because I don't know the background of everyone in the audience. But I mean, if you feel that I'm going too slow or anything, just ask me, just tell me and I will go a bit faster. So first of all, since we are going to talk about the velocity of convergence of certain quantum dissipative evolutions to the thermal equilibriums, well, it's clear that we need to study these kind of models because in a realistic setting, we know that no experiment can be really executed at zero temperature or be completely shielded from noise. So this is why we need to study open quantum many-body systems. And in particular, we study systems that are contained in an environment with which they are weakly coupled. And the resulting dynamics in such systems is dissipative, which means that an initial state on the initial system is going to have a certain energy, and this energy is going to tend to dissipate with time. And what we are going to do is see how fast this energy dissipates, essentially. And in this case, we are going to assume certain approximations, which are called Markovian approximation. And in this case, the continuous time evolution of an initial state on the system is going to be given by a quantum Markov semigroup. So I'm going to introduce all these mathematical concepts now. Firstly, let me just give some notation so that we see the notation that is going to appear throughout the whole talk. I'm going to be talking all the time about finite lattices. So they are just finite subsets of CD in the form that I'm writing here. So it's just a square lattice. And to every side of the lattice, we are just going to associate a finite dimensional Hilbert space. We'll just assume that all of them have the same dimension. Then the global Hilbert space associated to the global lattice is going to be just a tensor product everywhere of the local Hilbert spaces. And I'm just going to denote by B sub lambda the set of bounded linear operators from the Hilbert space to itself. And by S sub lambda, the set of density matrices that have support in the whole lambda, in the whole lattice. Okay, so this is probably very basic, but just to set up the notation and the notions that we are explaining here. Of course, when we have an isolated system, we know that the physical evolution of a density matrix on the system is given by the conjugation by some unitaries. So in particular, it's something reversible. But now we have something dissipative. So we have a non-reversible evolution because the energy is going to tend to dissipate. And we need to model it by a map that takes the density matrix to something else. And we need to see how this map is. And first we need that it maps states for density matrices to density matrices. So in particular, this means that the map needs to be linear, positive, and trace preserving. And apart from that, since the map is going to act only on the density matrix that takes support on the lattice itself, on the system itself, we need that when you tensorize with a state in the environment, and this state has a trivial evolution, what you need to get there is still something positive. So in particular, this means that when taking the tensor product of this map with an identity for every dimension where you are considering the identity, this needs to be positive. And in particular, this means that this map needs to be completely positive. And this is why this evolution is modeled by a quantum channel. So in particular, what I'm saying here is that for every instant of time, the corresponding time slice is just a quantum channel. So every t sub t is going to be a quantum channel. But now we need to glue all the, to see how this evolution behaves, we need to glue all these quantum channels. And for that, we need to find a continuous time description. And it's very difficult to do that in general without assuming anything else on the environment of the system, on the heat bath. So first, the first assumption that we have to make there is that the heat bath is going to be much bigger than the system. And in the sense that the system is not going to infer a lot on what happens in the heat bath. So essentially, we can just assume that the heat bath is not going to change during the whole process. And the second thing that we need to assume is that what happens in the heat bath in the future doesn't depend on what happened in the past, but just what happens in the present. And this is what is called the Markovian approximation, in the same sense of what a quantum Markov process is in the classical case. Okay, so this is just a hand-waving intuition of how to describe the continuous description of a dissipative evolution, of a dissipative quantum evolution. But now, mathematically, essentially, this can be described by something that is called a quantum Markov semigroup. And this is just a semigroup of operators, which are completely positive tree-preserving maps, as I said in the previous slide. And they have just one parameter, which in this case is going to be the time. And since this is a semigroup, it satisfies the two properties that I write here. So when you compose two elements at instant t and s, you just get the element at instant t plus s. And the first element of the whole semigroup is just the identity map. And since we are working in finite dimensional systems all the time, in particular, what we know is that there's an operator that is this L that I write here, which is called the infinitesimal generator of the semigroup, such that when you compose it with your map at instant t on the right side or on the left side, this coincides just with taking the derivative with respect to time of your map at instant t. And this is what is called Liouville's equation or Master's equation. So because of this, this is why the infinitesimal generator is frequently called Liouvillean, but also because of the form that it takes, because of the description of the heat bath and the system and how they are weakly coupled, because of this description that I write here. This description is due to Lindblad, so this is why it's also called Lindbladian. So I'm generally going to call it Lindbladian all the time. And this in particular allows us to integrate the equalities that are, well, this master equation. And this tells us that every element of the semigroup of quantum channels can be described as the exponential with time of the infinitesimal generator. And this is something we are going to use frequently during the talk. Okay, so the last two things I have to say about the quantum Markov semigroup are two properties that we have to assume. First of all, we need to assume that the quantum Markov semigroup has a unique invariant state, which is full rank. And we are going to denote it all the time by sigma or sigma sub lambda. And this is something that we need to assume essentially on the heat bath. So once we assume certain properties on the heat bath, we can have guaranteed the existence of a unique invariant state. But these are very particular properties of the heat bath. And the second thing that we need to assume here is some form of reversibility, which essentially gives us like some symmetry in the process. And this is just some detailed balance condition. So it tells us that when we consider the weighted inner product between two operators F and G, now in the Heisenberg picture, where the weighted inner product is given by this, then essentially the operator L is self-adjoint with respect to this inner product. So it doesn't really matter to have L here or L here. And this is this condition of reversibility. And these are just some mathematical conditions, but once we assume both of them, as well as the form of the quantum semigroup that I was mentioning before, then what we have is the following. So now if we denote by rho sub t the evolution of our density matrix rho after a certain time t, then what we know is that when t tends to infinity, Our process is always going to converge to the unique full rank invariant state that we were assuming here. And this is pretty important. So it essentially tells us that it doesn't really matter how we initialize the system that we are modeling by lambda, because we are always going to have convergence. And now the only thing we are interested on is, okay, we're going to have convergence in the infinite time limit, but how fast is this convergence going to happen? How is this going to scale with lambda? And this is interesting for many reasons. I will introduce something to measure, in some sense, the speed of convergence of this evolution to the thermal equilibrium. And after that, and I will say a bit about some possible applications of this speed evolution, these quick evolutions. So to measure this speed of convergence, we introduce something that is called the mixing time of the semigroup or the generator, because that's equivalent. And essentially, the mixing time of the semigroup for a certain parameter epsilon larger than zero is given by the minimum instant of time, such that every time that you consider a density matrix and you let it evolve after this time, it has already fallen into a ball of center sigma and radius given by epsilon. So this is essentially what the mixing time is telling us. And sigma, as I recall you, this is the thermal equilibrium of, I mean, this, sorry, this is the fixed point of the evolution. And we say that this mixing time is actually rapid, so there's some rapid mixing, when the epsilon given in the definition of the mixing time is something that it scales polynomially with the system size and decays exponentially with time. So essentially, the important part for us is the polynomially scaling with the system size. And this is, well, this is something that you see, right? It's something, I mean, for the kind of processes that we will usually consider here, these thermal evolutions, something that is natural to find some scaling exponential with the system size. And when there's some polynomial scaling, which is something much stronger, the system has some nice applications, some nice properties. Like, for example, when this rapid mixing property is satisfied, first of all, one property of the system is that it's stable against local perturbations. So essentially, it means that if we consider the Dellin-Bladian and we add like a small local perturbation, then if the system has rapid mixing, the original one, then the perturbed system also has rapid mixing. And another important feature of systems with rapid mixing is that they have an area law for the mutual information, for example, among many other things. So in particular, we are interested on these rapid mixing systems for two applications that we have on mind. Well, they have to do with things related in a very hand-wavy way to the construction of quantum computer, right? So first of all, one of the problems that you find in the description of construction of a quantum computer has to do with noise. And one of the nice features of these quantum Markov semigroups is that there are many noises that appear in things related, sorry, to, I mean, in there are many noises that appear in quantum prototypes for devices that can be modeled by quantum Markov semigroups. Like, I don't know, the most typical one is the polarizing channel, for example. It can be modeled as a quantum Markov semigroup. And some other important features is that when you have rapid mixing, so when you have some speed some quick convergence to the equilibrium, if you have a process that converges fast to the equilibrium, then one of the problems that you could find if you are trying to model a quantum memory with this system, for example, is that you don't have time to have some error correction. So in particular, this would mean that this is bad for trying to do error correction. But on the other side, systems that have rapid mixing are systems in which it's very easy to, or there are tools to have some learning of the equilibrium, which is usually taken as a Gibbs state. So this gives us like good consequences and bad consequences of having rapid mixing. Okay, so I'm going to show you now a way to have an example of rapid mixing. So for that, let me remind you of the master equation that was given by this expression here. And we are going to consider now the relative entropy between the evolved state after a certain time t and the equilibrium to which it converges. So now, if we differentiate with respect to time, this relative entropy, we get the expression that I'm writing here, which is something quite straightforward from the master equation. And now the thing is that we have a relative entropy between two density matrices, so this is always larger than or equal to zero. And we have a derivative, I mean, the process, rho sub t, is converging to the thermal equilibrium. So in particular, this means that the relative entropy is going to be smaller, it's going to decrease with time. And in particular, it means that the derivative is going to be negative, but it's going to have absolute value decreasing too. So this is something that in mathematics is frequently used to provide something that is called a functional inequality, which is just to have an upper bound for one quantity in terms of the derivative of that quantity. And in this case, it would be in terms of minus the derivative, because now both the relative entropy and minus its derivative are both positive. So in particular, this allows us, of course, to establish an inequality between both of them. And we can establish that inequality for each state rho and for each instant t. But the problem would be to try to find a parameter like a constant alpha that we can put here so that this inequality always holds. This is a hard problem. And this constant, the optimal constant that one could put here, is actually what is called the Lhotse-Walewski constant that I was mentioning at the beginning of the talk. So this is essentially the modified logarithmic Sobolev inequality constant, or just in this case, I'm going to call it Lhotse-Walewski constant for simplicity. And this is just the, as I said, the optimal constant that one would put in this inequality so that this always holds. So this is just defined as the infimum over all density matrix, on lambda, of minus the derivative of the relative entropy over twice the relative entropy. This is how it's defined in general. And what we are interested on, as I mentioned at the beginning, if you remember, is that is on proving that this is positive. And of course, if the system is well, I mean, if the generator is well defined, this quotient is always well defined in the sense that this is always something positive. And when we take infimum, since lambda is finite dimensional, this is a compact. So this infimum is in particular a minimum, and it means that this infimum of the quotients is going to be positive. So you could say, okay, it's a very cheap problem because it's always positive. So it's not really important to study when it's positive. Okay, so when I was saying that we're interested in studying when this is positive, I meant that we're interested in studying, when the limit, the thermodynamic limit of these constants of a family of Lindbladians is positive, in the sense that we need this for every lambda to be something positive, but also scaling properly with the size of lambda. Because now, as I said, we are interested on the thermodynamic limit of this kind of quantities. And when the limit is positive, then what we do here is integrate the inequality in the previous slide. And when we integrate this inequality, we obtain the inequality that I'm writing here. And this inequality is an entropy decay. And this is why what we are studying here is essentially an entropy decay, because finding positive Lhotse-Walewski constants and finding rates of entropy decays are in this case equivalent. And now, once we have this form of entropy decay, if we put it together with Pinsker's inequality, we obtain, and we also find, we also look for the worst case scenario of the relative entropy, then we find the inequality that I'm writing here. So essentially, we can upper bound the one norm of the difference between the evolved state and the equilibrium by something that scales with the log of the inverse of the minimal eigenvalue of the fixed point, and something that decays exponentially with time. And well, as I said at the beginning, we're interested in the case in which our fixed point of the evolution or equilibrium is in particular a thermal equilibrium, so it's a thermal state. So when we have a thermal state, the minimal eigenvalue of this sigma is actually going to scale inversely with the exponential of the size of lambda. So you see that now if we have this rate, if we include it in this bound, what we have here is something essentially that scales polynomially with lambda, with the size of lambda. So if you remember the definition of rapid mixing, this is just the expression for rapidism. So essentially it tells us that if we have a positive MLSI constant, then we have rapid mixing. And this is why to have rapid mixing, what we do now is just to find positive MLSI constants. So this is why we have reduced the problem to this one. And actually, it's important that we use or that we find that we look for MLSI constants, like for positivity of MLSI constants. Because if we reduce to the case of the gap, for example, which is much simpler because then terms involved in the definition are easier to control and are easier to study. In that case, it was shown that actually the one norm of the difference between the evolved state and the equilibrium is given by something that scales the like the inverse of the minimal eigenvalue, the square root of the inverse of the minimal eigenvalue. And you see there's a factor log of difference between one bound and the other. So essentially, this tells us that for thermal states, in principle, MLSI is going to give us rapid mixing, but gap is not. This is a way to say that. It's just some intuition. So, okay, what I just said can be actually summarized in something that is half contained in this scheme that I just put here. So essentially, I just showed you that the Log-Sobolev constant implies rapid mixing. And well, you could believe that Log-Sobolev constant implies gap because they are constructed in a similar way, but this is stronger than this one. And I just gave you an intuition that spectral gap doesn't imply rapid mixing. And as I said before, rapid mixing has some nice properties of stability and area law. Okay, so I was talking all the time just about these properties, which are dynamical properties of a semigroup. So they are properties that depend on time. But actually the interesting thing of these problems are that one can relate these properties that strongly depend on time with some property that has nothing to do with time, some property that just has to do with the equilibrium, with the equilibrium of that evolution. So now this equilibrium is going to be taken to be a Gibbs state, so something of the form that I'm writing here. And as I said here, there's no time involved. Here, this is just some static condition. And what was shown in 2013 is that rapid mixing implies exponential degree of correlations in some form. It has to do with, like, for example, with this definition that I'm writing here. So this is the typical form of exponential degree of correlations. And now what we try to do here is to study which kind of conditions of degree of correlations can imply a positivity of Log-Sobolev constant. So of course, when I'm writing all these arrows, I don't mean a direct equivalence of or implications, because of course, the spectral gap was shown to be equivalent to a certain form of exponential degree of correlations, which is something that is much weaker. So it's something that wouldn't be able to imply Log-Sobolev constant. And the conditions that we need to impose now for as exponential degree of correlations on Gibbs state to imply MLSI constants are something that is much stronger. So the long-term goal of this project, if one wants to say it like that, would be to see which forms of degree of correlations characterize which forms of functional inequalities and which forms of mixing times, so that one can actually see that there's a difference, on how correlations decay, how different measures of correlations decay on Gibbs state with respect to how fast certain evolutions converge to those Gibbs states. So the idea would be in the long term, would be to try to classify dissipative phases of matter with respect to the mixing time and with respect to this rapid mixing property. So essentially to see for certain states at different dimensions and with different temperatures to see whether there's fast mixing or not, and therefore use this connection to a certain form of exponential degree of correlations to classify the phases of matter with respect to that mean. Okay, so essentially, as I said before, what we want to prove is that this limit is positive. And what we are going to be able to prove in general, or what we are going to be able to see in general, is that it can be reduced to something that depends on the size of lambda And then we will need to prove that this is positive, that this is something that is going to be hard in general. So what one would like to have here would be something closer to what happens for classical spin systems, which is essentially that you can reduce your MLSI in lambda to your MLSI in a subregion A containing in lambda. And this is multiplied by something that only depends on the size of A, which is the price you have to pay to reduce from here to here, let's say that. And then, since these two things only depend on A, when one takes the limit with lambda tending to the thermodynamic limit, this is just positive. So this is what we would like to see. But this is something that is not going to happen in general because of the correlations, because it's impossible to lose the completely the correlations between A and its complement in the quantum setting. So what we will be able to show in some cases is that one can actually reduce the MLSI in lambda to something that is called a conditional MLSI of lambda in A, and then of course paying the price of this term with the size of A. And then this is what we will be able in some cases to show that is positive. And right now everything is very hand wavy and everything is just full of intuition. But I'm going to try to put some math into that so that you see actually how all this holds. Okay, so the first thing we will have to do is once we have MLSI in lambda, we will need to reduce it to a conditional MLSI in A. And this is something that we are going to define in this form. So this was the definition that we had for the MLSI in lambda. And then to reduce it to this conditional MLSI in A, what we are going to do is take the numerator and change the generator here in lambda to the generator in A. And this is something that we can easily do because our generator is always going to be local in the sense that it's going to be the sum of some terms that are indexed in K for every K in lambda, for every site in lambda. And this doesn't mean that these terms only have support in K, but in K and something that is nearby K, because this is going to be usually given by the Hamiltonian of the system. And so this essentially means that to define the numerator here, this is pretty easy because then to define L sub A, we just need to take the terms here that are indexed in the sites in A. So this is pretty easy. And now the difficult part is going to be the denominator, because the denominator here just has the relative entropy between two states in with supporting in the whole lambda. And now we will need to have something in the denominator, which is going to be a conditional relative entropy in A. It cannot be just a relative entropy with states with supporting in A, because in this case we would lose too much and it wouldn't be possible to reduce one thing to the other. But we just need to have some conditional relative entropy that we will need to introduce accordingly in each case. So it's something that we cannot introduce universally. And once we have that, we will follow on a strategy that has five different steps, like five different pieces of a puzzle, if you want to see it like that. And the first thing we will have to do is define a conditional Lotzkovitz constant, because even if we defined it here generally, as I said, we need to define the conditional relative entropy for each particular case. So this is equivalent to just defining the conditional MLSI constant for each particular case. And the second thing we will need to do for each system is to study the degree of correlations on the Gibbs state of the system. And once we know the degree of correlations that we are taking in the case and the conditional Lotzkovitz constant that we are defining in such a case, then we will need to have three different pieces of three different results we will need to prove. The first one of them is something that is called a quasi-factorization of the relative entropy, which is just something that will allow us to reduce this relative entropy to this conditional relative entropy. The second thing is a geometric recursive argument that will essentially allow us to reduce this MLSI constant to this conditional MLSI constant by paying the price of this multiplicative factor. And then the last thing that is left to do is to prove that this is actually positive. So this is essentially proving that this conditional MLSI constant is positive. And this is the last piece of the puzzle. So you see that this strategy is quite reasonable, all the steps that we have to follow in order to prove that an MLSI is positive. And well, I just said that the main step we will have to prove is a quasi factorization of the relative entropy. And I told you that it's just to reduce this to this, but to give you a better intuition of what it is, it's an inequality of the form that I'm writing here. So essentially, if we have a tripartite system ADC, a quasi factorization for the relative entropy will be just an upper bound for the relative entropy between two states in terms of two conditional relative entropies between overlapping systems. So on the one part we have AB and on the other one we have BC. And we will have some multiplicative error term. And this multiplicative error term is where the decay of correlations will enter into place. So it's something that is going to measure essentially how far sigma AC is from being a tensor product between A and C. So I mean, this is why it's going to measure the correlations between sigma A and sigma C. Well, the correlations in sigma between A and C. Okay, so this is like a general form for this quasi-factorization, and then we will see some particular examples for this. So this was the strategy that we are going to follow to prove MLSIs in general. And this is something that without giving an example is maybe a bit difficult to see how it works. So the next thing I'm going to do is to give you like the most simple example where we've used this strategy and to see how it works. So the first example where we used it was for the generalized depolarizing semigroup, which is essentially given equivalently by the generator that I'm writing here, which is called the heat path generator in general. And it's just, as you see the expression here, so we take a density matrix on a lattice lambda, we trace out site X, and we recompose it with our state sigma just in X. And then we see how far we are from the initial density matrix in lambda. And we sum all the we sum this difference over all possible sites of the lattice. So this is how this generator works. And in this particular case, I'm not going to give you details why, but we needed this conditional relative entropy to satisfy certain assumptions that are quite reasonable just to extend the classical spin systems and also to extend the conditional, the form of a conditional entropy into having two density matrices. And because of that, we were able to characterize the form of the conditional relative entropy as essentially the difference between the relative entropy between the two density matrices in the global lattice and the relative entropy between the same density matrices, but now just in the complement of X. So this is how we are defining the conditional relative entropy in X. And what we are assuming here as a decay of correlations is not decay of correlations, but just no correlations at all. So we are assuming it's the simplest case. So we are assuming the strongest condition for the decay of correlations piece. And we are just assuming that this is a tensor product everywhere in between every site of the lattice. So as I said, this is what gives us the definition for the conditional MLSI. So this gives us the piece in the middle. This gives us the blue piece in the outer part. And now we just need to prove the other three things. The first part is some result of quasi-factorization for the relative entropy. And before I said that it should be something on this form, and this parameter here, this error term should give us how far the state is from being a tensor product, but in our case, it's a tensor product. So this is just nothing, this is just a one. And apart, because of having this error term that is so simple, we don't only get a sum of two things as here, of two conditional relative entropies, but we get a sum everywhere. And then this is the quasi-factorization. Once we have it, what we do is just to replace the conditional relative entropy in X by the definition of the conditional MLSI, and then we obtain the quotient that I'm writing here. Now we just take out of the sum the infimum of all these conditional MLSIs, which we can do because, as I said, we are in a finite lattice. And now we just have a sum of all these terms here, but you see that this is local, this is linear, sorry, with respect to the generator. So we can introduce the sum inside the trace. And if we sum all these local generators, we just recover the generator in lambda, because this is a property that all our generators have, in particular this one. And this is, in this case, this geometric recursive argument, which in this case is not very recursive, but it's pretty simple because of the geometry we have here. And now to conclude, the only thing we need to do is to see that this is actually something we can control. And this is, we prove that all these conditional MLSIs are lower bounded by 1/2. So this is why it disappears in the next step, because we prove this positivity of these constants. And then if you take a look at the beginning and the last part of the inequality, and then now you take a quotient of the right part over the left part and taking FIMU, you see that what we are proving here is just that the MLSI is larger than or equal to 1/2. So, I mean, it's a very simple example, but it was actually something unknown before we could prove it. So it's nice. It was a way to see that the strategy could work, that it was a very simple case, but the strategy could work and it was something to build on. So, okay, now we can go for some harder examples. And for that, what we have to do is to, of course, look for more physically relevant situations. And in particular, this means that we should look for Gibbs states that have some correlations. I'm not going to go into details of all the things that we've been doing in this line, because I just want to present the last result we've proven. So just to see that there's a huge difference between the first thing that we proved and what we are proving now, what I want to give you here is an intuition of the different dynamics we've had to explore in this time, and why they are better or worse, depending on what we are considering. So in every case now we are considering this sigma to be a Gibbs state of a finite range commuting Hamiltonian. And now we have explored three different forms of dynamics. So something that is the Hilbert dynamics, something that is the Divis dynamics, and something that is the Schmidt dynamics. So first, for the Hilbert dynamics, this is just what I was mentioning in the previous example. But now our sigma, in principle, is not tensor product everywhere. So now this is not as simple as it was before, like this. But now this is just, if you're familiar with recovery maps, this is just the PETS recovery map for the partial tracing X composed with the partial tracing X itself applied to rho and the map with respect to sigma. And this is how we reconstruct the site that we are tracing out for each rho. We reconstruct it with sigma with this PETS recovery map. And we see how far it is from the initial density matrix. And this is a very nice form of dynamics from the mathematical point of view, because it's very easy to describe. So this means that there are many tools that one can actually apply here. But the problem is that from the physical point of view, this is not very, very, very realizable. I mean, this is not very physically relevant, let's say that. So consulting the physical literature, some much more interesting dynamics is that given by the Davis dynamics, the Davis generator, which is expressed in the form that I'm writing here. So it's essentially, it has some part that only depends on conjugating by the Hamiltonian on the system. And the other part is the part that encodes the interactions between the system and the heat bath, and also the terms of just the heat bath. And the nice feature of this Davis generator, without going into detail, is that the terms that I'm writing here are defined in terms of the Fourier coefficients of the correlation functions in the bath and the ones of the system couplings. So this in particular means that even if it's pretty close to the standard form of Lindblad for the generator, it has some simplifications that make it a bit more tractable, but still it's very difficult to include a formula like this one in the expressions for Loxov-Volev constants. So it's very difficult to work with it. But of course, the aim would be to try to prove positive MLSIs for this kind of dynamics, because they are the physically relevant ones. And then there's something I would say in between, in the sense that it's easier to describe than the Davis generator, but it's also harder than the heat bath. And it's something that physically has more relevance than the Hilbert generator. And it's this Schmidt generator, which can be written as the sum of the difference between some conditional expectations applied to your observable and your observable itself. So it's something that is similar in spirit to this PETS recovery map. But now actually this is really a conditional expectation. And the nice feature that it has is that when one writes down the form of these conditional expectations, they actually only depend on what happens in X and some small boundary around X. So it's kind of easy to work with them mathematically. So it's something that considering hardness is in between these two cases. Okay, so just after this short description, let me just see how this starting point was for the result I'm going to present here. So first of all, as I said before, just to remind you, the MLSI gives you some rapid mixing, some bound of this form, but the spectral gap doesn't. And what was proven before all this strategy and all this works was that for the heat bath and the Davis dynamics in 1D, because now I'm just going to restrict to 1D, the generator, both the heat bath and the Davis generator, always have a positive spectral gap that is independent of the system size. And this happens for every temperature. So what one would like to do now would be to lift this result from spectral gap to MLSI and to prove the same for MLSI, because it would give us an exponential improvement from here to here. And well, the starting point considering MLSI now is, as I just showed you before, the case of the heat bath generator with tensor plot of fixed point. And then in this case, we saw that it has a positive MLSI constant. So there's a lot there's a huge way to go from here to the analogous result here for the MLSI. And what we did was then to, I'm not going to go into details with this scheme here, but what we did was just to follow some roadmap that has allowed us to subsequently lift some results of quasi factorization to some other harder results. And these results that are all in blue have provided several results of positive MLSIs, which are the results in orange. And the first one that I'm showing here in the left part is the one I told you before. And then each of them is harder than the previous one. And this is the last thing we had before the result I'm going to tell you now. So this was just for local commuting Hamiltonians at high temperature, as this is something else that we have to assume for the degree of correlations. And in this case, it worked for Hamiltonians that were classical 1D and nearest neighbor. So any of these three cases. And in all these cases, what we could prove was that there is a positive MLSI. So you see that 1D was already here, but it was only a high temperature, and it was only for Schmidt semigroups, which is something that I'm not saying here. And as I said, we're interested in the Davis semigroups. So this is essentially what we've done now. We finally managed to prove that for Davis semigroups, when we have a unique fixed point that is given by the Gibbs state of a commuting finite range translation invariant, this is something new that we have to assume, Hamiltonian, but at any temperature, so at every positive temperature in 1D, then we have a positive MLSI. But now you see that it's not a constant. It's actually something that scales with the inverse of the logarithm of the size of lambda. And what could think that maybe this is a problem, but actually you see that this MLSI constant is going to appear in the exponent of an exponential. So essentially scaling as the inverse of the logarithm of the size of lambda is actually something that gives us something polynomial with lambda. So this is still valid to provide a positive MLSI. So this is why this is enough for us to prove an MLSI scaling in this form, because it still provides some rapid mixing, which is what we are interested in. And in the last part of the talk, what I'm going to do is to give you an intuition of how this proof works. So I'm not going to explain the details here because the proof is like 40 pages long or so, but at least I want to give you some intuition with some pictures, because I think some ideas behind the proof are nice. And the first thing that we have to do is, as I said, we are always following this strategy with these five pieces. So the first thing that we have to do is to have this quasi-factorization for the relative entropy. And for that, we first need to see which kind of conditional relative entropies we are going to use. And in this case, the problem is much harder than the one I showed you before. We actually need to use two different forms of conditional relative entropies. The one that is the difference between the two relative entropies, as I said before, And another one that is just a relative entropy between a density matrix and a conditional expectation on the system where we are conditioning of the same density matrix. And in this case, this conditional expectation is something that is called the heat bath conditional expectation, which is just, again, the PETS recovery map for the partial trace in X with respect to this state sigma composed with the partial trace in X itself. And now we apply it n times and we take the limit with n tending to infinity. So this, it can be shown that this actually provides a conditional expectation, and this is the one we need to take here. But first, we are going to restrict just to the first notion of conditional relative entropy I'm writing here, the simpler one, if you want to say that. And in this case, for a tripartite system XYZ, what we have proven is the inequality I'm writing here, which is just an upper bound for the relative entropy between your states rho and sigma in terms of the two conditional relative entropies XY and YZ, as I said before. And now this multiplicative error term, if you remember, I said it should measure how far sigma is from linear tensor plot between X and Z, and it does it in this form. So the multiplicative error term we get is this one. And you see that if sigma is a tensor plot between X and Z, then this is just an identity. So this the whole term inside the infinity norm is just a zero. And then the multiplicative error term is just a one. So this is why it measures that. And this is something that we have generally for systems at every dimension and without assuming anything on sigma. But now we are going to apply it in our particular case. So if you remember, we are just in 1D, and it doesn't really, the bound I wrote here doesn't really depend on the geometry of X, Y, and Z. So in particular, we can take them to be non-connected sets as we are doing here. So now our X, Y are just going to be A and B, Y, Z. So A is going to be composed of the union of some small segments A1, A2, and so on in this form. And then we are going to take a B that is going to be composed of some segments B1, B2, and so on. Then they are going to overlap pairwise, as I'm drawing here. And this continues, of course. And the important thing is that the size of all the segments and the size of the overlaps is always the same. It doesn't change. So now, as I said, we take A to be the union of all the AIs, and we take B to be the union of all the BIs. And then we apply the previous quasi factorization result. And we have the inequality that I'm writing here. So okay, so we have the inequality that I'm writing here. And you might wonder why I'm considering construction of A and B as I'm doing here. And the whole point of doing that is that if A1 and A2 are separated enough, we can actually split the conditional relative entropy that I'm writing here, the conditional relative entropy in A, in the conditional relative entropies in each of the AIs. And this is something that, if you remember, it's pretty similar to the case of the tensor product everywhere that I was mentioning before. So in this case, of course, sigma is not a tensor product everywhere, but sigma is a quantum Markov chain between each of the segments, A1, for example, its boundary, and the complement. So this in particular means that we can write sigma as a direct sum of tensor products, even if it's not a tensor product, it's a direct sum of tensor products. And then if A1 and A2 are separated enough, in the sense that A2 doesn't overlap with the boundary of A1, then this allows us to reduce the conditional relative entropy in A, the sum of the conditional relative entropies in all the AIs. And this is pretty cool, because now we are really reducing the relative entropy in the whole system to the conditional relative entropies in some systems that are not going to grow with lambda. So putting these two inequalities together, we have the inequality that I'm writing here with this error term. And now the error term, you see that it's something that still depends on the global A and B, and it's something that we need to control with the degree of correlations. So actually, This error term is measuring how far the correlations, how fast the correlations decay between the complement of A and the complement of B. So here I'm rating the complement of B, I'm rating it as the CIs in this picture, and the complement of A are just the DIs, and these AEIs and FIs are just the distance, are measuring the distance between these complements. And what we can do is use some other recent result that we proved, which essentially tells us that if we have three systems S, Y, and Z, such that Y shields X from Z in the form of the picture I'm writing here, then the correlations between X and Z of this form decay exponentially fast with the size of Y. So essentially, the product of sigma XZ by the inverse of the marginals, the distance of that to the identity decays with the exponentially with the size of Y. And you see that this is actually something that we could apply in the setting that we have here, but well, for this particular case we proved we really need to have something connected, and here we have something that is clearly disconnected. So what we need to do is apply it recursively in a smart way, essentially. And once we do that, we actually show that this error term that we had multiplying in our quasi-factorization result is uniformly bounded as long as the number of segments one considers here, the number of segments AIs and BIs, is something that scales with the size of lambda over logarithm of the size of lambda. So this is something that can be controlled. Good, so until here, we have found the piece of quasi-factorization, we have the piece of the definition of conditional MLSI, and we have used the decay of correlations. And now the next thing that we have to do is the geometric recursive argument. So we need to reduce here, using this, our MLSI in the global lambda to our conditional MLSIs. And for that, the first thing we have to do is to change our conditional relative entropies, the ones that we were using before, to the other ones with the conditional expectation. And this is something we can do thanks to some bound we proved in a previous paper. And therefore, if we put all these pieces together, what we can do is just to have an upper bound for the relative entropy in terms of this multiplicative error term that now we can bound by a constant, as I said before. And the sum of all these conditional relative entropies with the conditional expectations. And now by taking the definition of the conditional MLSI that I'm writing here at the bottom part of this slide, we can actually write a lower bound for the MLSI in the global lambda in terms of some constant and the minimum between all the conditional MLSIs in all the AIs and all the BIs, which are actually going to be very similar, all of them, because we're assuming translation invariancy. So essentially, this means that we could just take any of them. Okay, so this is the geometric recursive argument. We have reduced our MLSI to these conditional MLSIs and something that is constant and controlled. So the only thing that is left to do, if you remember, is just to prove that these conditional MLSIs are positive. And for that, well, we will need to prove that the infimum of this quotient is positive. And this is something that we don't know how to do yet. But what we can do is to use some reduction of conditional relative entropies in each of the segments to the sum of the conditional relative entropies with the conditional expectations in each side of each of the segments. And the price we have to pay here is something that depends on the size of the segment on AI. So this is something controlled. And this is something that also appeared in a paper last year. And the important thing of this constant here is that it's something that has to do with the inverse of the logarithm of a certain constant that is pretty similar to the spectral gap. And one thing can be reduced to the other thanks to the detectability demo. So essentially, I'm not going into detail here, but essentially what this tells us is that thanks to the fact that there's this result of Castoriano and Brandão, where they proved that there's a spectral gap in 1D always for commuting heap samplers, thanks to that, we can actually prove that this constant scales logarithmically with the size of lambda, because we were taking the size of the segments to be logarithmic with the size of lambda, you remember, because we were taking the number of segments to be of order size of lambda over log of the size of lambda. So because of having this, we have a constant now that scales logarithmically with the size of lambda. And the only thing that is left to do here, okay, you're paying here a price of logarithmic with the size of lambda, but now you have reduced this to this conditional relative entropies in each of the sites. So therefore, this means that we can reduce now the global MLSI to the conditional MLSIs in each of the sites separately. And the only thing left to do is to prove that these conditional MLSIs in each of the sites are positive. And this is also a consequence of some previous paper from last year, in which they proved that something that is a bit different than the MLSI, but is something called the complete MLSI, which is just MLSI tensorizing with identity, this is positive. So once we have this, we have positivity of these conditional MLSIs. And therefore, you can see, I mean, there's some subtlety now. You can see that this result is for Davis generators. And all the things I was mentioning here are for heat path generators, because we are taking this heat path conditional expectation that I mentioned before. So you could be thinking that I'm cheating because I'm talking about two different quantities, but actually the last subtlety we need to take into account is that if you take the heat path conditional expectation and you take the Davis conditional expectation, which is given just by the projector with the local Davis generator, then both conditional expectations coincide. This is something that we also proved in the past. So this in particular tells us that proving something for heat path is equivalent to proving it for Davis, and then we can combine tools from something and the other. And putting everything together, what we have shown is that for each Davis generator at every temperature in 1D, there is a positive MLSI constant that scales inversely with the logarithm of the size of lambda. And therefore, these systems have rapid mixing. And since they always have rapid mixing, this in particular means that there is no dissipative phase transition when considering the temperature in 1D systems for quantum Markovsen groups. Okay, so to conclude, let me just wrap up and just state the take-home message. So what we've done here is to introduce MLSI as a tool to prove rapid mixing, because we want to prove examples of rapid mixing because they have plenty of applications. And for that, we've used some results of quasi-factorization on relative entropy and decay of correlations on Gibbs states. And in particular, I've shown you at the end the sketch of a proof for a relevant physical system in 1D. So I hope that I've convinced you that this form of the strategy works in physically relevant systems. And now there are many open problems that one can think of. I just mentioned a couple of them here. One of them has to do with having an MLSI that is independent of the system size instead of depending inversely of the with the logarithm of the size of lambda. And another possible open problem would be, okay, you have just done something for one dimension. So what happens if you try to consider something similar in higher dimensions? So of course, if you consider square lattice, you would never expect this to hold for every temperature at higher dimensions than one, because you have problems with the decay of correlations. So you know that correlations are not going to decay fast at low temperature, but still one could think of this problem just at high temperatures and see what happens. So that's all I wanted to tell you. And I really thank you for your attention. And now I'll take your questions.
Great, let's all thank Angela for a really fantastic talk. And yeah, we'll open it up to questions, so please just unmute yourself and ask a question.
If there's no competition for questions, I want to ask a couple more fundamental ones. So in the open problem, you mentioned about the dependence on the system size. So yes. Currently, you prove something that is one over log the system size. Do you have a sense whether you may potentially get a counterexample that is exponential in size?
Counterexample for what? Sorry, for
so the so currently you get a constant that is 1/log lambda.
Yeah, you mean in this particular case? Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Is it conceivable that if you have a system lambda that is really large, to the point that the bound become meaningless?
Yes.
Is it conceivable to come up with some situation in which you actually don't have rapid missing?
That's a good point. We haven't really thought about that, but at least in this particular case, I suspect it wouldn't be a problem because, okay, this result shows that we have this dependence, as you say, that is inverse with the logarithm of the size of lambda, but actually we think we can lift it to constant. So we have some new techniques that we are trying to explore now and see if we can actually lift it to constant. So in this case, I think that particular situation wouldn't be a problem. And in general, I agree with you that maybe there would be some counterexample. It would be interesting to explore it, but so far we haven't done it.
And earlier in the, I think it is at the beginning of the segment on the mixing time and logs, superlev inequalities. Yeah, yeah, this diagram on the loop. Yeah, this one.
Yeah,
very nice diagram. So there is this one step that is proved to be not holding from special gap to replicating. Is that what cross mean there?
Yeah, this is not a proof. Okay. So there's not a general proof of this. This is just like an intuition to say that at least there are some examples in which it doesn't happen. That there are some examples in which you have spectral gap that provides the boundary I'm writing here. And since the minimal eigenvalue of sigma should scale in this form, it wouldn't give you rapid mixing. So there are some particular examples in which it happens, but we don't have like a clear counterexample of something with a spectral gap that doesn't satisfy rapid mixing. Like for classical spin systems, for example, everything is equivalent. So for classical spin systems, actually having spectral gap would mean that you have rapid mixing. So it's a bit difficult to cook examples of like counterexamples for this cross, yeah.
So every time you prove something in your project, then you get one proof from spectral gap to rapid mixing.
Not
because
really.
You have three steps to go around.
No, but that's the thing. The spectral gap, the arrow that it's coming here, it's for a certain form of decay of correlations, and it's not the same that I'm using to go to log sub LF. So that's why I said that these arrows shouldn't be taken as equivalences, but just as so this box that I'm writing as an exponential decay of correlations is actually a box with certain forms of decay of correlations, and then the one that is equivalent to the spectral gap is not the same that is that the one that is used to prove log sub LF constant. Otherwise, I agree with you. I would be proving that spectral gap in place rapid mixing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Thanks. Sorry that I missed some of these details.
No, not at all. Thanks for the questions.
While we're on this slide, I think I had a question about something interesting comment you made when you were talking about this slide earlier. So you said you were maybe long term, you could use this to classify phases of matter. Is this like you've got these equilibrium phases and you can classify them by looking at the Lindblad's evolutions where that states the fixed point? Have I got that right, or is it something else you're implying?
So it's essentially what I meant there is essentially that I would like I guess what I'm trying to say here is that to classify phases of matter dissipatively, what I would like to use is a certain form of decay of correlations, like a certain form of a measure of correlations, and see that it decays with a certain rate for certain systems, and like a certain temperature, for example, and it decays with a different rate at a different temperature, and then there's like a dissipative phase transition in between. And this is something that with this diagram, you cannot do that, because of course you only have implications, but you don't have equivalences. So you don't have like a complete characterization of what it means to have a mixing time scaling polynomially with the size of lambda, or mixing time scaling exponentially with the size of lambda. So the goal, the long-term goal of this project would be, if it's possible, to completely characterize all of this, like to say, for example, log-sub-level constant is actually equivalent to rapid mixing, and it's equivalent to having exponential decay of the mutual information, for example. And a spectral gap is equivalent to having exponential mixing time in the sense that is mixing time scaling exponentially with the size of lambda, which is equivalent to having exponential degree of correlations with the measure of correlations that I read here, but not with the mutual information. And see that there's actually like a separation between all these things. But of course, this is full of conjectures. Like now there are many arrows. We know that spectral gap implies this degree of correlations. We know that log-sub-level constant implies exponential decay of correlations in the mutual information. So one would expect that maybe the opposite direction also holds, but there's a lot of conjecture in between. And I don't know if it would be maybe too ambitious to call it like a classification of phases of matter with respect to dissipation, but it's something that appears sometimes in the physics literature, and this is why I was calling it like that. I don't know if this more or less answered the question.
Yeah, it did. Thank you. It sounds like a really cool research program. Do we have any other questions?
So, Angela, did you have any specific ideas about area law in higher dimensions? Is there any angle on it from this approach?
I don't know if this approach could be applied to that, but it would be really interesting because this is a very relevant problem. I know it would be great to make some progress on it, but I don't really see how to use like this, for example, these quasi-factorization tools or something like that for that problem. I wish.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we all wish. Yes.
Exactly.
Thanks.
Okay. Unless there's more questions, let's all thank Angela once again for a great talk.
Thanks a lot for inviting me.